Hi, I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 191 of Caro Pop. If you'd like to support us, please go to caropop.com. Our guest this week is a vivid, perceptive storyteller who does his best work in song, Craig Finn. He's the frontman lyricist of The Hold Steady, the rousing indie rock band that has released 9 albums since 2004.
The Eddies almost killed me. Let's not recall him quite so fondly. Some Kennedy OD'd while we watched on MTV. And in the 90s, we were wired and well-connected. Put it all down on technology and lost everything we invested. Gotta start a world of positive jam.
He also has released 6 solo albums since 2012. The latest, which came out earlier this year, is an ambitious song cycle titled Always Been.
Honestly, I've been a couple people. Knowing that I'd want to be again.
The Hold Steady performed residencies in Brooklyn, Philadelphia, Minneapolis, and London this summer and spring. Finn has been performing solo as well, with another slate of shows starting July 27th in Skokie, Illinois, and running through the end of the year. The ones in November are with Patterson Hood of Drive-By Truckers. If all that weren't enough, Finn has a Substack called Versions of Security, and he hosts a podcast called That's How I Remember It. No surprise, the podcast is really thoughtful and provocative as it explores the relationship between memory and creativity. The first question he asks each artist guest is, do you consider yourself someone who has a good memory? Finn has an answer to that question as well, and many thoughts on how memory fuels his songwriting and factors into the characters and settings he creates. He grew up in the Minneapolis area and formed the band Lifter Puller there. The Hold Steady came a few years after Lifter Puller's breakup and after Finn's move to New York City, where he lives now. He recorded Always Been in Los Angeles. How much does the sense of place factor into his songs? What's the deal with the Randy Newman nod on the cover of Always Been? How much backstory does he conceive for his song's characters, including the faith-challenged pastor at the center of Always Been?
There's a pamphlet on the windshield with a cartoon of a shepherd tending to some cartoon sheep. Said we'll walk you through the paperwork.
Did Finn ever consider being a short story writer or, God forbid, a journalist? What is it about songwriting that separates it from poetry? What's the relationship between his lyrics and music, whether in The Hold Steady, where his bandmates provide the musical bed, or his solo work? Does he write songs in the order of the story? Craig Finn has thought a lot about this stuff, and it's no surprise that he's really fun to talk music with. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Craig Finn.
Yes, sir, tell my story again.
I find it interesting that the focus of your podcast is about how memory affects people's stories and how they tell them the stories that they tell themselves and others.
Yeah.
Is that how you experience like your own songwriting? Do you feel like that's all springing from these wells of memory?
Partially. Yeah. I mean, I think we mine our memory for these details that we build stories on, whether or not they're fictional. One of the things that came up in an early guest in the podcast was my very good friend, Eddie Kitsis, that's a television writer. And he talked about this thing called what he calls the hollow bunny theory, which is like if you have one of those Easter bunnies around Easter and it's chocolate, there's the ones that are hollow and there's the ones that are solid. And the solid ones are so much nicer to bite into.
Right.
But the ones, if you don't get the details right, he's saying, even if you're making up a story about something you've never done, if you get the details right, it's the solid bunny. And I really love that. And I bring it up a lot because I think it's true. You know, I say, like, if I write a story about robbing a bank, I've never robbed a bank. But if I make all the details right, if I set that bank in a bank that I've walked by 400 times and I know the business next to it and I know how it's laid out, I can tell that story in a more, in a better way, I think. And so I think your memory, you know, no matter what world you're building, you rely on your memory. And I think that, you know, one of the fascinating things about the podcast, one of the things I was fascinated about going in was a particular book called Night of the Gun by David Carr, the journalist. And and he was a friend, and you know, he's deceased now, but he talks in that book about kind of investigating himself. He had been an addict in the Twin Cities where I grew up. And he, after he learned, you know, after he got sober and he had a really great career as a journalist, he sort of went back and applied his investigative journalist techniques to his own life and found that he had really built a lot of the story of to himself incorrectly. You know, for instance, he'd been arrested a few more times than he thought he had. And his case was extreme because he was in addiction. But just some of the stories that when he compared notes that were 30 years old, some other people had way different versions of those stories. And I found that interesting because, as you say, and as in the tagline of my podcast, it's also the stories we tell ourselves.
If you're using these memories to create something that's, you know, fictional storytelling, like do you have more room to embellish if your memories are maybe a little fuzzy, as opposed to if you remember every single detail, because then you're so conscious of, well, I had to change that.
Well, I think we're writers ultimately, and I think we have to give ourselves space, you know? I mean, I think another great guest I had was Alex Edelman, and the comedian, and he was like, look, you know, at some point you have a responsibility to your audience to be entertaining. And, you know, I think that has to kick in at some point. I mean, if I wrote the songs only about the details of my life, I'm fond of saying all my songs would be about going to the grocery store and the post office, and no one wants to hear that. Not umpteen songs about it anyway. So I think you're always trying to create a balance, but I think in order to create fictional work that's honest, you know, I think this is where your memory and your own personal experiences and some of those details come in.
Well, your first question you ask everyone is, do you consider yourself someone who has a good memory? What's been the split of answers on that?
That's interesting, because I thought going in, I had a thesis that everyone would say what I would say is, I have a very good memory and I'm telling the right version of the story. And I would say it's 50-50, and a lot of people qualify it and say, I'm good at this, but not this. I mean, I have a lot of musicians for obvious reasons, and a lot of them, unsurprisingly, are like, well, I'm great at remembering arcana, you know, like B-sides of 7 inches. And I'm not so good at remembering my wife's birthday. You know, there's that kind of brain that I think gravitates towards music. That kind of, you know, little details. But I think it's about 50-50. I think people say, you know, I think there's a tendency for people to say, no, I'm terrible, you know. But I think when they get talking and start to say, you know what I am good at? I had just had Red Cross, the band from LA on.
Oh, yeah. I had them. I love those guys.
And I love them. And I was really excited to have them on. And they actually just put that one up today. And Jeff McDonald said one that I loved. He says he almost has a photographic memory for instruments. If he sees a band, he can remember exactly what instruments they played. And I was like, wow, that's fascinating. That was a new one to me. Like,
interesting.
Like, first concert, you know, if he once saw Elton John in 1974, he remembers what the bass player was playing, what the guitar player was playing, etc.
Well, and Steven's been through so much kind of trauma from a young age. I mean, he had these crazy, you know, kidnapping adventure, and like those are cases where you would think your mind would maybe actively suppress parts of it. So I would imagine he has a different relationship to memory than Jeff, perhaps. I mean,
well, they had a really cool thing where they were talking, because they did it together.
Yeah.
I mean, and they were like in the same room, like sitting side by side. And they kind of admitted that they sort of share a memory as brothers. They, you know, they're brothers, and they've spent so much time together that they kind of rely on this sort of group memory between the two of them, which was very cool to talk about. I mean, they were some of my favorite guests. I was very thrilled to have them. I'm a huge fan. And but I hadn't, you know, when you talk about families and brothers or even bands, there is something to that of like a shared memory.
And I would assume you're someone who considers yourself having a good memory.
I do. And it's sort of reinforced by the band. Like, you know, the whole study will be like, Craig, have we played this club before? You know? So that, I've demonstrated my memory in certain situations that people seem to agree with me. My partner, Angie, would agree that I have a good memory because I can remember conversations really well. But, you know, things come up all the time where I say, oh, I forgot about that. You know, it's far from perfect.
Well, and when you're having an argument, the memory thing becomes a really annoying thing, because you'll start like reiterating, no, I said this, and then you said that, and then I said this, and you're like, don't go into all those details. I don't want to hear that.
Yeah, and it's sort of saying like, well, you know, that was September 2004. I don't really, I can change my mind since then.
But do you feel like it's the memory part of it is fueling your storytelling and kind of the details? I mean, because you observe things and you'll be somewhere and you'll think, oh, this would be a good setting for a song, or you'll see some behavior, and then you come up with a story. You're a storyteller. Is harking back to your memory helping you do that then?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that, like, for instance, on my new record, Always Bandit, well, you know, a lot of it takes place on the some of it takes place in the Delaware shore, although I don't think they call it the Delaware Shore down there, but I'm not sure what the local vernacular for the beach is down there. But I would vacation there many summers through a family member. And, you know, I spend at least a week there most years. And I just sort of had a feeling there that I was trying to, that I kept thinking about when I started this record, and what it would feel like to be there in the off season, especially, because it's not quite the abandoned amusement park of Bruce Springsteen. You know, it's something that's maybe a little more rural but still built for the summer. You know, the buildings might not, you know, there might be some seasonal businesses, etc. So there was this one sort of emotional feeling I would get from that place that I wanted to, and a certain type of loneliness that I kind of wanted to tap into when I started this record. And that's, those details are how they surface in my songs.
Yeah, there's that sense of he's in the vacation home that is when his parents aren't there during the week, and then he has to kind of clear out on the weekend, which is a very, again, specific thing, and that does give you kind of the sense of it's a little sad. It's like, it's on one hand, it's nice, parents have a vacation home on the Delaware Shore, and on the other hand, well, but you know, you're only there during the week because you got to clear out on the weekend.
Yeah, and there's certain honesty of the fact that, like, he's not coming from rags. You know, his parents have a beach house, you know, that's nice, as you say, but the fact that he's washed up there as an adult and has to, you know, is only there because no one's there and using it during the week is a detail that's difficult. And you know, I think I knew about a situation like that that I was able to draw from.
So Always Been is one of these albums that people would call a song cycle, because a lot of the songs are connected, and you have this character who's a pastor who's sort of lost faith and trying to figure things out. Do you think of the whole story and then start writing the individual songs, or do you write a song and then think, oh, this is like where this could go?
In some cases, yes, but in this one, no. I wrote that first song, Bethany, which is the first song on the record. And I've never written a song that was such a first. It was like, I wrote that song and I said, well, I'd like to keep writing about that character. And then when I went to make the record, it was the first song I showed the producer, Adam Grandisiel. It was the first song we recorded. And then, of course, when we sequenced the record, it sort of had to be first. I that was one where I just sort of wrote it and I said, I think that's, it could be, I could keep putting a microscope up to this. And so, you know, there's this line about, you know, he has to go on the weekend, when his parents show up, he goes to his sister's with her daughter on the fringe of Philadelphia. And I kind of just put a microscope up to that and said, that could be a whole song. What happens in their house? And then I wrote the third song in the record, Crumbs. So I just kind of kept going back to that song and sort of enlarging things. And that's how this record worked. And not all the songs are about that one story. I had sort of a couple other ones that came up, and I included them. I remember I was explaining to my manager this record, and I said, you know, almost all the songs are about this one thing, but then there's a couple other that are sort of these bottle episodes, or, you know,
right,
like that are, you know, related, and I see them in the world, but they don't move that particular story forward. And so I said, in that sense, maybe it's like a Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoon. And he said, that doesn't sound very hip. You should say Pulp Fiction. So it's like one or the other.
Yeah, or The Bear or something. You've got your 11 episodes and a few bottle episodes where they go off to Copenhagen or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Otherwise, they're around.
although it's different characters. So I thought those Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoons had those like little cartoons within it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the turtle that went back in time, etc. It was creating a world, but it really did start in that case with that one song.
Did you write most of them in the order, like roughly in the order that they appear on the album, or were you sort of, you know, writing Shamrock early, but then thought, oh, this is a good album closer?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, really, they were all out of order, and I kind of sequenced them in a way that, you know, I think part of the fun always is trying to figure it out. So I sequenced it in a way that, you know, didn't maybe wasn't the most linear, but I didn't write them in order, but I kind of just kept saying like, well, what about that part of his life? I did go back and write like sort of a prose thing to sort of just tell the story to myself and just create a lot of details to draw from. So I knew what was happening along the way. I ended up doing kind of a companion book along with the record. And some of that came from that as I sort of got the character straight. And the more I wrote, the more I got to know the characters. And it really helped. I mean, in the sense that, and I think this is something I'm learning as I get older, that, you know, to create a great story, sometimes all you can really show the listener, the reader, the audience is the tip of the iceberg. But if you know how deep it goes under the surface, then you're creating a story that, I think has an even better chance of connecting.
Right. It's kind of a method actor thing too, right? You need to know your character when you go into, you know, even if it doesn't show up in the movie, it's good to know what happened in 10th grade or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Or like, you know, where he was stationed in the army, where he came back from, where, you know, how, where he started, where he ended.
So, and this is a real songwriter 101 question, but what's the relation of the lyrics to the music in your process of finishing these songs?
I think like I tend to sort of start at the beginning. Usually I often have a few chords in the first line and then the second line. It always starts with a very simple chord progression, just something that I can kind of vibe to. I've read about different songwriters, and Paul Simon's the one that I really relate to, and that he kind of says, like, you know, he writes a line and then he writes the next line to answer that one and keeps going. And that probably best describes my process. I don't write big choruses, but I don't think I've ever had a song where I've knew the chorus and then like went back, you know, and wrote the verses. I think that I kind of stumble on the chorus. If there is, there is a chorus, it ends up sort of being like, okay, it needs to change now. Maybe it goes to a big major chord. And what's that line, you know? And that might end up being sort of the name of the song or something. But I don't get there until sort of I need to get there.
You're not one of these writers who like the phrase hits your head and you're like, oh, I need to write a song called Don't Bring Me Down or whatever, you know, it's.
No, no. In fact, I often discover, you know, it's through the process that I discover what the song title is going to be, what the, you know, what the sort of repeating line is going to be, et cetera. It's through just starting at the top, you know, starting at the top or the bottom, depending on how you look at it.
Yeah, no, the repeating line is in it because it's not a chorus. Sometimes it's a refrain, but not necessarily. But sometimes you'll sort of take a key phrase and you'll just repeat it to kind of like drive home the emotion of what's going on in the song at that point.
Yeah, I mean, like People of Substance is one of those songs. And I definitely did not set out to write a song called People of Substance. I just had the line, Dana, I don't get depressed anymore. And you know, went from there. I sort of was like, okay, well, he's trying to talk to his ex and explain that he's cured, he's better. And so what would that be like? And so I came to wasted so much time on people without any substance. And I thought, oh, well, that's kind of a cool line. And that bears repeating.
What? All right, this is going back now, going in the way back machine to throw another Rocky and Bullwinkle reference in. When you come up with a line like "Tramps like us and we like tramps," is that something where you're just writing the lyrics and that occurs to you, or do you sort of did you kind of have that one in your back pocket and you thought I got to get that into a song?
You know, that's interesting because I don't totally remember, but I would say that I used to be more diligent about, you know, having a notebook and throwing, you know, phrases in there and sort of mining them when I needed songs. And even though that now I've kind of switched to the phone, you know, a lot of us have notes app kind of worlds, I do less of that. I do still have a running tally, but I don't go of things, but I don't go back to it as much as I used to. I sort of stay in the present. But I think part of that is I really have in the past, say, decade or a little more, started really a creative practice where I'm sitting down in the morning every morning and writing. So I don't think I'm, you know, searching for inspiration as much as I'm just sort of working on things.
You got like a notebook and set of notebooks that you work in, like longhand as opposed to on your laptop or your phone notes thing?
It's a laptop situation these days. It's funny. I mean, I have two boxes filled with notebooks, and those are just like, you know, if there was ever an archive and they just end, you know, and because like the last notebook I bought never sort of just got filled up because I kind of got out of the practice, but I'm not lamenting that. It's just, it's the reality is I'm just sort of like, I like the formality of sitting down and closing the door and saying like, I'm going to write this morning. And, you know, until about roughly noon, most days I put a few hours in starting with my first cup of coffee.
Will you have like complete lyrics done and then really go back with, you know, guitar in hand and say, okay, I got to make this work as a song now? Or is it still kind of a little bit of back and forth? Like I got this chord change, I'm vibing on that. It needs something else here. I'll get to this later.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes I do. Sometimes I like, just like, we'll say like, and then there's a third verse and I'll put like, it needs four lines and I'll say X, 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 just to sort of denote, I, you know, need to work right there. But the best way to describe my process on songwriting is I have this like nylon string guitar, you know, small classical guitar that I use. And I try to get it to the point, like I always say, like, I want to get it to the point where I can go down to an open mic night and sing the song to the people there and it would make sense to them. And I've always depended on producers to kind of take things to the next level with making a record, but I want to get it to the point where I would be unembarrassed to play this song for strangers, you know. Yeah. and they would understand what it was about and understand it was a song. And so I'm kind of working always to get it to that point, and then I sort of move on to the next one.
You obviously a very talented writer, you know, and you have a Substack too, drawing on that memory. Was there a point where you sort of thought to yourself, like, I could be like a writer, you know, like in print, short stories, journalism, God forbid, or whatever. Or I could sort of direct this into music. Like, was it a conscious decision or was it just kind of like instinctively you always wanted to sort of channel this thing into musical format as opposed to, you know, trying to sell short stories and novels?
It was a conscious decision in that, or it wasn't a conscious decision in the sense that I always wanted to be around bands, be in bands, you know, be around music. That was the thing that excited me. I think socially, those are the people I wanted to hang out with, kind of, you know. I thought musicians were cool rather than, you know, other options. I think when I got in bands and when I got, you know, to writing songs and playing them for people, the people kind of reacted to the words mostly, you know, and certainly not my singing or my playing. So it was like, and then I thought, well, this is what I can bring, you know. I mean, I think it's like, how can I be helpful? This is the one thing I can bring, and maybe I can do in a way that gets people's attention, And if I find people that do the other things good, that's, you know, that's going to work. It's actually the opposite in some way, because after that, you know, maybe 10, 15 years ago, I have tried writing longer things and found it very difficult, partially because I'm a social creature. And I think, like, being in a band and getting immediate feedback from people and saying, like, oh, that's great, you know, is more somehow makes me more motivated than sitting and, you know, trying to write a novel or something, which is very solitary. At the same time, that is something I hope to do before I leave this earth, you know, because, you know, that is a goal of mine. But the other thing, and this is, I say this, and it's not really a joke. It's that when I think of a story, it tends to become a song. And, you know, I don't really save it for the bigger treatment. So I'd have to work on that a little bit. I'm trying to think about that. What would that make a bigger, longer form thing? But ultimately, I do think the culture of music and the people and the excitement of performing is a huge part of it. I mean, I am a pretty big reader of fiction, and I go to readings, you know, and you're like excited to hear your favorite author read. And it's oftentimes really disappointing, you know, because no one goes out and kind of hits you in the face that like, you know, seeing Nick Cave or something like that.
Well, and so many people now experience books on tape as opposed to sitting with in the corner. I'm still like a physical book, you know, on the couch kind of person. But yeah, if you can hear a book on tape, you know, you can hear it's the story sung to you, and there, you know, hooks, and there's an emotional connection you get with music that is different from what you get from just the printed word.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, I with very few exceptions, I've never read poetry. And however, I love, you know, the lyrics are my favorite parts of songs. So the introduction of melody and delivery and all of that is what makes it interesting to me.
Do you find that your needs for music, or what you want to get out of music when you're creating music, different now than they were, you know, back in the Lifter Puller days or early Hold Steady, or just, you know, when you're figuring this stuff out?
I think, yeah. I mean, I've actually been thinking a lot about that, because, you know, I remember just like going in the 90s, you know, when I was in Lifter Puller, and a lot of the bands around town, a lot of the stuff we were going to see, a lot of the, you know, music we were into, it was this sort of like, it was music that I don't connect to emotionally now, because it didn't always say a lot. It kind of just sort of impressed you with its belligerence, or it's, you know, having a drummer that went hit really hard or something like that. You know, there wasn't like anything, a lot of 90s indie rock, or even, you know, even the harder side of indie rock, there wasn't much that made me feel like, oh man, I felt like that too. That's a really thing that you made me think. It's more just like, whoa, that was intense. That was like the emotion that I kept saying, like, that was intense. And now I think I really do want to make a connection with people, especially on an adult level. You know, I mean, I think I want to write songs that someone my age can understand, because that's sort of where I'm coming from. And I think when we keep creating, it's like, you know, like when you're a kid and they mark your height against the wall in the kitchen. And I think, you know, you may not change as much adult as physically, you might not grow taller, but your perspective's changing. And so, like, you know, my perspective from making a record in 2015 is different from a record I made in 2025 by 10 years. And that to me is interesting. And the stories, you know, we're telling, that is sort of my goal, is to make an emotional connection in a different way.
Well, and obviously your sensibility runs through those old, the Hold Steady records, and, you know, your solo albums. you know, I wouldn't say that Always Been is a spare record, but it's certainly a different experience than kind of the bigness of, you know, a 20-year-old Hold Steady record. And, you know, do you still kind of hold those two things in your side? I was like, well, you know, part of me still wants to go big and that sort of thing. And the part of me wants to sort of do the solo thing and have a little more intimate experience. Or is it really more like this is where I am now?
I think, you know, I mean, I feel blessed to be able to do both because it is fun to get with your friends and play big rock songs and have people shout along and throw beer in the air. And, you know, in the Hold Steady, I'm often in the creative process, I'm generally writing the words. So I'm often reacting to music that's been giving me that's big. So the stories tend to have to be bigger. So, like, you know, people in Hold Steady songs do bigger. They might make quicker moves or more desperate moves, etc.
You're really working from more the musical bed already when you write those songs.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, I mean, I think like one thing that I think about in regards to sort of the growth or the path is that, you know, a lot of those early Hold Steady songs were, you know, a lot of them featured people partying, you know, making bad decisions, etc. And, you know, I'm fond of saying like those songs are about people making bad decisions and following them to their logical and awful conclusions. Well, a lot of my work in the last few years has been people who are trying to do the right thing, but coming up short in other ways or not, you know, not getting their head above water. And I see that more, you know, at my age and maybe in our world that we live in now. One of the biggest ways I think it's expressed is, you know, I think I've in the last where I would write a lot about partying 10, 15, 20 years ago, definitely 15, 20. I write a lot more about mental health now. And I think I see it as the same thing, a different side of the same coin. You know, I mean, I think, you know, people going to excess is, you know, it looks different to me at 50, almost 54 than it did at 35.
Absolutely. I think you said on one of the podcasts that early on you wanted to tell fucked up stories and now you're more interested in dignity.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I was actually joking with my friend, John Darnielle, who's an amazing songwriter. I was like, you know, you watch those shows. Like there's a show, there's always like, the, you know, like intervention, that kind of thing about people who have addiction problems. And that the character that's always most fascinating to me is the grandma who keeps giving him $200 every day, you know? And it's like, well, that's the story right there. Like, why, what is happening there? You know, like that to me is so much more interesting now than why that person is he's getting fucked up is like, how are these relationships being exploited and why, where's the guilt? Where's the family, you know, history, the secret, etc. And fear and all that, that is a bigger part of the story.
There was music in the plazas and a lifting of the fear. When we pressed ourselves together, then our God was nowhere near. All the drinking left us legless, so we slithered through the streets. The car alarms, they cussed us out, the birds put us to sleep. She said, hold on.
How much does your memory of music kind of affect your appreciation of music? Like when you think back of music that you were enjoying, whether it was in the 90s or whatever, you associate it with where you were. When you listen to it now, is like, how much is the memory affecting your processing of that?
It's big. I mean, actually, you bring up the 90s, and I think a little bit that, like, I don't love 90s music as a whole, as a decade, as much as, you know, there's stuff I do really like. Like, I'm not discounting the whole decade, but I also think that I was in my 20s in the 90s. I think your 20s are kind of hard. So I kind of, my 20s weren't my favorite decade. You know, I thought being a teenager was pretty great. And then I thought once I turned 30, it was pretty great too, you know, but like the 20s, I just sort of felt like, you know, they want you to become an adult, but they sort of also don't let you, you know, like you're that's sort of my review of it. Like you're expected to grow up, but then there's not really a place at the table for you either. So I don't know. It was, I don't like, I don't go back to the, that when people are like, oh man, the 90s, I'm like, I don't know. That music doesn't really speak to me that much. You know, grunge didn't really speak to me. It et cetera. But I also think there's this thing about being a music fan that I found interesting as an adult is that like, I'm really interested as I get still, and I still love music and I still listen to music a lot. And I'm really interested in kind of piecing things together as like, wait, when did that happen? And what was before, you know? I mean, like, you know, I mean, like there's, I was just like, during the pandemic, I did a thing where every day I'd take a walk and I would listen to, because I felt like I had a hole a little bit in my knowledge of the band The Kinks. And so every day I would listen to a Kinks record in chronological order and take a walk, you know, for the length of the record. And, you know, and I got through the whole catalog and now I feel fairly informed. But it was like, oh my God, like Lola, that record came out in 1971, the year I was born. That I had in my mind that it was like 76. Okay, so then I think about the song Top of the Pops from that record, and I'm listening to that, and I'm like, this sounds like Kiss. Kiss definitely heard this record.
Oh, yeah.
And brought, like, that's Kiss. And even the lyric, And so like making those associations, like who heard what and did with it next. The other band that like I'm fascinated, I think, is like I can't quite put it into perfect words, but like I think Mötley Crüe is like the key to so much stuff, as a skeleton key. And I guess Bowie too. I guess you'd say Bowie, you know, before Mötley Crüe, but Mötley Crüe to me is like so such a key to a lot of things I really like, is maybe a better way of saying it. You know, piano based rock and roll, and you know, proto punk, etc. So yeah, I mean, being a music fan to me is launching these investigations now and trying to get things in the right order.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a few years older than you are. I kind of feel like I was always on two tracks on sort of, you know, digging into music and falling in love with music. There was kind of the stuff that I was hearing on the radio at the time, but then there was kind of the older stuff that I kept discovering. And honestly, I think I had a more intense reaction to the older stuff, you know, like discovering, you know, the Beatles and all the songs running together around side two of Abbey Road. I mean, I wasn't hearing that when it came out, but I was just like, oh, this is really cool. Or what would it have been like to hear Sgt. Pepper for the first time? And the Kinks records, I mean, I went on a Kinks kick later in life also, but for me that sweet spot was like 65 to 70, right? Or maybe 71. But it's like I loved A's and Village Green Preservation Society, whereas, you know, like when I was experiencing Kinks as Come Dancing was coming out, I'm State of Confusion, I'm like, well, okay, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I saw him when I was in eighth grade on the like State of Confusion tour, I think it was, and you know, it was just kind of an arena rock band or a small arena rock band. It was, you know, they obviously did so many things. The other crazy one that you know, well, too, but that like I can't that I really came up with punk and indie rock, so like I did not investigate classic rock till I was older, 20s, which is why the Hold Steady ended up being kind of coming up, because I was like, oh, I like all this, you know, like
right.
I didn't know Goat's Head Soup when I was a teenager. It was like, but and I liked so much music that was influenced by David Bowie before. I mean, like the Psychedelic Furs were my favorite, you know, one of my favorite bands. It wasn't until my 20s that I started listening to David Bowie records and being like, oh, all this new wave stuff is right. Bowie, you know? And even later, I started to realize like, oh man, like Bob Dylan, you know, Lou Reed and Bruce Springsteen are both, you know, taking, you know, two of my favorites are taking a lot from Bob Dylan in a way that I hadn't quite considered. And maybe even the Beatles and maybe even the Rolling Stones, you know, is there sympathy for the devil without Bob Dylan? I don't know, you know? So putting all that stuff, investigating all that stuff is a fascinating part of being a music fan and maybe my favorite part now.
Yeah, I'll just say one more indulgent thing about this from my end, and then we'll move on. But when I was growing up, it was kind of when new wave, like punk new wave, was kind of, you know, taking over from. I mean, and when I was, you know, younger, I mean, much younger, I was like listening to, you know, I hear like, you know, Billy Joel and ELO, and I got really excited when, you know, Breakfast in America by Supertramp came out, and I went back and discovered Crime of the Century, which is a much more rocking, dynamic, beautifully recorded record. And I was like, oh, this is like the best record of the 70s. And again, this is like 5 years after it had come out. And then I'm listening to, you know, Talking Heads, Fear of Music, and Costello, and Squeeze, and XTC. And that stuff was stupid. You know, it's like, I've sort of put it all aside. Like, no, I outgrew all that. But then later I would come back and I'd put on like Crime of the Century again. And I'd be like, no, this just has this like pull on me, even though there are things in it that I could now kind of poke at a little bit. But that memory again of what it meant to you at the time when the music later in life, no matter how great it is, just means something different to you and maybe not as intense.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's stuff like, I mean, Queen was a band that like which I understand, like it's kick ass. And like, I was a kid, I really liked things like that, you know, because it was intense and it went wild. And I put that aside for many years when I got into, you know, Husker Du.
Right.
Now I absolutely love, you give yourself permission to like both. I mean, I was a Kiss fan when I was a kid, and then I kind of got embarrassed about it. And I remember when the Replacements put out Black Diamond, I was appreciative. Like, it was like, you know, I remember buying Let It Be, which is still my favorite record of all the time, and seeing on the, you know, side A, end of the side A, Black Diamond. And I said, that can't be the same song. And sure enough, it is. And it gave me sort of permission to be okay with it in a way, and understanding that like, yeah, like, of course the Replacements no Kiss and might have some enjoyment, but I thought it was two separate things back, you know, at that age.
Yeah, Red Cross are great at mining that stuff. I mean, they covered Deuce, and yep, they did this Osmond song, Crazy Horses. That,
yeah.
I went back and found the Osmonds version of that. That's like an insane, like, heavy song from the Osmonds.
They know so much about, like, those Stephen and Jeff know so much about, like, that kind of pop culture stuff.
Yeah. So, and speaking of references, the cover of Always Been is basically the cover of Little Criminals, Randy Newman. Where did that come from that you thought, okay, this is like my version of that record? I mean, the records are pretty different, but they're obviously singer-songwriters.
Yeah. Well, I've always loved that record cover. So that was the start of it. And I, so one thing was like, when I made Always Been with producer Adam Granuseal from The War on Drugs, one of the things we kind of connected on was some of that LA songwriter stuff. Warren Zevon being the big one. I'd gone up and played Accidentally Like a Martyr with them in Brooklyn. And I'd sung, what else did we do? Play It All Night Long. So that was like an artist we connected on. And I was kind of thinking, I've always kind of wanted to make an LA record, or maybe a better way of saying it is I'd always wanted to go spend time in LA while I was making a record. But it ended up being kind of, you know, some of the musical touchstones we talked about. I was listening to a lot of that second Jackson Browne record, For Every Man. And, you know, we were sort of grooving on that, that kind of music, that kind of songwriter. And, you know, I was out in LA for a while, back and forth making the record. And I thought, well, you know, so when I started to think about what's in LA, what would be a record cover that we could do that was sort of nod to LA? And that sort of popped in my head. And I was like, oh, how hard would it be to find the actual bridge that we're standing on? And it's, you know, one Google search away. And I was just like, well, that's it. Let's go try it. And so my very good friend, Dan Monick, who was in Lifter Puller with me, is a photographer and lives in LA. He got it right away. We went and did it, and I was like, yeah, this is it. And it's a nod. It's kind of for the heads, you know. It's like, you know, the people that'll know it right away, they're like, yep, that's it. But I didn't say it. I just sort of let it.
Right. Well, yeah, there are other album covers you could have done where it's like more obvious because they're a little more stylized. I mean, even something like Randy Newman's Trouble in Paradise, if you used the same typography and wore the same shirt, it would be more obvious, but this was sort of like, oh wait, that looks familiar or whatever. And then,
well, the interesting thing is so much later that the it doesn't exactly look the same. Even though I'm standing in the same place, buildings have been built, etc.
Is that one of your favorite Randy Newman albums?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, yeah, I've always loved that one. And I'll eat down to the title, Little Criminals. That's like, you know, that's such a great, great. I mean, that's like what a lot of his songs seem to be about, Little Criminals.
Right. Was that your entry point into him? And then you sort of move backwards and forwards, or?
Yeah. I think that's right. You know, he's always been someone who's been there in different ways. And that's an artist that I probably didn't get into until my 30s, mid 30s, because that's something that would have all that stuff, really, the songwriter stuff coming out of punk and indie rock. You know, I in my 20s, I probably would have thought that was indulgent in some way, in a way that I wasn't interested in, compared to, you know, a band that was intense, as I mentioned before.
Right. Yeah. I mean, Good Old Boys, the album before Little Criminals, is kind of one of these song cycles also, where you have like characters who are, you know, Marie will show up in a couple of different songs in a row, and then you'll have your little bottle episodes of The Wedding in Cherokee County. And, but it's definitely like sort of a mood, as well.
That's an incredibly ambitious record to me. And extremely impressive, you know, the way he kind of dives into the history and all that, in a very cool way.
So, and then you're going to go out live. You're going to actually be near me pretty soon for this Out of Space show you're doing at the end of the month, in Skokie. And, so you're going out, it's sort of on a solo tour. You've done these residencies with the Hold Steady. It looks like in November you're going out with, Patterson Hood, yeah, to do some, how do you approach the whole, like what you do live, how much you play live, and sort of what combinations or, you know, things that make it work for you?
Well, the Hold Steady, since 2016, we've really started touring differently. We've done mainly these residencies, where we go to choose a city and go play three or four shows. And, you know, it with the band where we're at, where our fan base is at, et cetera, we found it to be an incredible model, that probably allows us to keep going into our 22nd year or however long it's been, you know. So we just did three in Philly, preceded by four in Minneapolis in May. And it's like once a month we do, you know, something, probably about 25 shows a year, 30 maybe. We also do one-offs. Like before I come to Evanston solo, we're going to be opening for Tyler Childers up at Alpine Valley.
Oh, wow.
The Hold Steady. So there's different things. But, you know, so that's kind of how we arrange the year with the Hold Steady. And then with the solo thing, what's really fun about it for me now, and especially since I have six solo albums now, so I have this pretty big catalog, to do different things, and also just kind of gather the confidence of being able to put different bands together, different formations. You know, when I play in Evanston, it's going to be a duo, and I did a whole tour with Bob Mould as a duo. It's me and this guy Nelson Devereaux, who plays synths and horns, sax, etc., and I play nylon string guitar, and it's super cool. I mean, the words really come across in that lineup, you know. I mean, it's definitely like the stories are cutting through in a way that doesn't always when there's a full rock band. So, you know, but at the same time, I've done, the other day I did a show in Brooklyn or in Manhattan with Adam and some of the War on Drugs guys, and then some of my other friends. And that was an eight of us on stage. And by the end of it, there was 11 of us on stage. And, so I think one of the cool things about the solo thing is the ability to, you know, move things around and change it up. So hopefully people are interested in, you know, what I'm trying to build is something where you're like, you don't know what's going to happen, what the presentation's going to be like. And, not that, you know, it just may change, from time to time, in a way to keep it interesting, both for me and for the audience.
When you're looking out on the audience or interacting with the audience, whether it's a Hold Steady show or a solo show, is it like the same people, the same crowds? Do you feel like there's a distinct audience for one versus the other?
I think that the material on the Hold Steady is much more kick ass in a way, you know, like
sure.
There's more, you know, throwing your beer in the air at a Hold Steady show, and it's more appropriate at a Hold Steady show. You know, I think I a lot of the people do cross over. The solo shows tend to be pretty quiet and listening and talky, you know, like I, you know, tend to tell more stories and explain more where the songs are coming from, etc., rather than a Hold Steady show where we're just plowing, you know, moving through songs. I think there's people that prefer one or the other. And you know, the Hold Steady shows tend to be bigger, but I think it's the solo thing that's really finding an audience. And you know, I'm very happy with the way that's going and the way, you know, it is rewarding to play as a guy who spends most of the time on, you know, as a lyricist, to play shows where that's really getting through and people are, you know, there's like, you know, a moment in a solo show where you get on stage, I get on stage and I play a song and it's got maybe a funny line, somewhere in the second verse and everyone laughs and you're like, oh, they're here to listen. And they're hearing the words, and that's just due to like volume and PA systems. Not always going to be the case at a Hold Steady show,
right? Well, just in general, when a band is like rocking out, it's like the it's just a different way of experiencing the words, you know. And I mean, there are plenty of bands that I could sing along, but I'm not necessarily sure what I'm singing. But it's like, hey, you know, it's like this some songs are about the words, and some are not. Like Paul McCartney's Jet is not about the words.
Right.
Nobody knows what the hell they're singing on that song. You just like singing it.
Yeah, I mean, the Strokes are the example I always use. Like I love the Strokes, but I don't, you know, like those aren't the songs. That's not why I love them. I mean, the lyrics are fine, but the songs are great.
Do you still enjoy that split of being able to do the big rock show and then also be able to do the quiet people listen to my words sort of thing, as opposed to like one kind of getting tired and the other is like, I wish I could just do this one?
No, it's a perfect sweet spot for me to be able to do both, because I think if I only got to do the Hold Steady, I would feel like, wow, you know. And I have in the past, I have felt like that, like, man, I'm not getting through, you know. There have been times, it was quite a while ago, that I was feeling that way, but this allows me to sort of be like, you know, flex that muscle and do, you know, some of these songs are telling very, you know, very linear specific stories. A story like Shamrock, you know, to set that to bass drums, big guitars, you know, that would just, the gentleness of that story would just go away.
Are you someone who writes like all the time, like works on songs all the time, and then just sort of, you know, if, you know, some of it doesn't end up in a project, that some of it does, you know? Or are you someone more where it's like, oh, okay, everyone wants to make a Hold Steady record now, they're giving me the music, I got to do this, as opposed to you sort of thinking of something and going, oh, this would be a good Hold Steady song?
No, I mean, the Hold Steady is definitely like, guys, let's make a record, you know, like start sending me stuff. And that may, you know, that may be 2 years, like, but you know, I'm saying like, you know, let's start hearing some stuff from you guys so I can start writing to it. And, we can start trying to form songs out of that, which is more of a process. And it's more of a process because A, we're in our 50s, and B, we all don't live in the same place. So there is like, you know, there's sort of this initial process where they're sending me stuff on Dropbox and I'm going through it and seeing what I think I could use. And then we get together and kind of, you know, finesse it into a song, and I write some more to that form. With the songs I'm writing, you know, solo songs, I'm writing all the time. And I think what I write, I kind of write up to the point where a theme begins to emerge often, you know, like in the past anyway. It's like I'm saying, these songs are starting to kind of hold together, you know, or make sense together. You know, if I write 20, and sometimes it's a matter of finding out what you're thinking. You know, you listen to, you write 20 songs, and and 12 of them are about you know, someone being ill, and then you're like, oh, I think that's what I'm thinking about.
You know? Right. Do you already have, like, you know, another album's worth of thoughts or songs, like the next solo album, that you think, okay, I was just here and it triggered these thoughts and I was thinking of these characters? Or is it still like, I'm just, you know, I'm doing this record now, and at some point I'll think and I'll get in that space?
I'm writing songs, but, you know, I'm sort of just sort of like seeing, there's this thing, and I talked to Adam Grandisill about this, where you're like, you know, and I think it's being a certain age and certain experience as an artist, where I'm just doing the work right now, you know, and I'm afforded the luxury that I'm fairly confident that if I do the work, it'll work out. Like, you know, I very much at this point in my life, like, say, like, if I sit down and write X amount of hours a day or put work in, it'll happen. But I'm in the part where I'm just working, you know. I don't know when, what this record will be. I don't know exactly. I'm making songs. I don't know. I don't have any idea about when I'm going to record it, who I'm going to record it with, but I'm just working.
So you just keep working. In other words, you're not project based, you're process based. You're just going to keep doing it. You keep observing, writing it down, take your writing time, and then see where it takes you.
Yeah, you know, I was the guy who helps me with design on records. His name's Vance Wallenstein. He was saying that he was talking about the idea of an artistic practice, you know, like a doctor as a practice medicine. And I think that that's it, you know, like you work and you know, these sort of the way you end up presenting it might come out of the work. And I, you know, and that's part of my process always. Like, there's a blank page and you fill up that page and then you edit it. And I think that's sort of, that's both small and big picture. You fill up your hard drive with work, and then you figure out how you're going to present it to the world.
And when you're preparing to do a Hold Steady record, do you have kind of group discussions where you think, hey, you know, thematically, I was thinking maybe, you know, we could do something on a, you know, Lonely Astronaut or whatever. I'm just pulling that off. But, you know, like you'll, you know, or I was thinking it would be great to be a little more keyboard based on this record, or, you know, let's try out some hip hop rhythms, or like, are there those discussions, or is it really like the music guys are going to come up with stuff and then you're going to just make it fit?
I mean, I think, to be honest, there are not a lot of discussions like that. It's more just like reacting to what I'm getting sent and then trying to figure it out. I think, you know, I do share sort of what I'm thinking about the lyrics, you know, like, it, you know, there's a theme that's coming up that I really kind of like, you know, and I'll share it with you in case it affects what you want to send me. But I am kind of reacting to what I'm being sent, but I do control isn't the right word, but I tend to be in charge of the lyrics. But no, we don't work that way necessarily. And, you know, I mean, it's actually something I'd sort of, wonder if we should sometimes, like, you know, like, but coming up with that conceptual, you know, that conceptual thing is it just means different things to different people. So there is also a sense that, you know, with a band, especially a band that's, you know, made up of largely 50-year-olds now, there's, you know, feeling like where it's feeling where the river's flowing and trying to just, you know, nudge it gently, rather than, you know, if you can.
Do you get sent the like exact amount of music that's going to wind up on the album? Or is there some where you'll be like, yeah, this one, I'm not feeling this one. I can't write anything on this, but I can write something good on this one.
100%. That's exactly what happens. And so the ideas that first come in aren't always like hugely developed. It's not like, this is the verse, this is the chorus. It might be like, here's, you know, an A part and a B part. And I might say like, okay, well, let's flip them. Let's write the verse is the B part, and then the chorus is the A part, because that's how I heard it. And then, you know, we kind of make adjustments from there and kind of map it out.
And at some point, there's probably one where you're like, I just don't like this one. This doesn't sound good to me.
Or it's maybe not a matter of I don't like it. It's that I'm not finding anything at this moment interesting I can do. Now, there are cases like I think Slapped Actress, which is on Stay Positive, Tad brought in for Separation Sunday, two records before, and I was like, I can't figure it out. And then he brought it back, and I was like, oh, I got something great for that. So, you know, sometimes it's just rehearing it new. It helps me. It really does help me to hear things in a raw, it's easier for me to hear something on a, you know, like my own writing is on a nylon string guitar rather than something where people put, you know, guitar, bass, drums, keys on it already.
Right.
Because it helps me to find my space to have, you know, it helps to have space to put myself into.
What's the turnaround like when they send you something? Are you usually pretty quick to come back with something, or will 6 months pass and they'll be like, where's Craig?
I'll usually be working on some one thing that they've sent me always, you know, but it might take me a week to kind of get it there and move on to the next thing. And sometimes I'd spend time on it and I'm just like, I don't know. I don't know. But it's usually pretty quick. I mean, it's usually pretty quick that I'm starting to work on something.
Like the REM sort of worked that way where, you know, the three of them and then the two of them would send Michael Stipe stuff and he would sort of come up with things. And my impression, which I shouldn't say publicly because I haven't confirmed this, my impression was that someone like Peter Buck turns around stuff pretty quickly and maybe Michael Stipe doesn't turn around stuff pretty quickly.
That's certainly what we'd think from, you know, the outside as fans, right? You know? But, you know, there's funny. And then sometimes there was a piece on, I guess it was on Open Door Policy that Steve had really recorded a full thing, like, you know, and he, you know, he had meant it sort of demonstrably to maybe be a rocker, but it was kind of like this piece that was pretty, you know, it was 3 minutes long or whatever. And I took that and I wrote a song called Parade Days over exactly the track that he sent. And I think I've heard about Michael Stipe doing that kind of thing too, where he, you know, they will send him and he'll make no adjustments to, hey, I need the chorus to go a little longer here, but he just does the whole, you know, he writes to exactly that track. And I've done that, and that's kind of a cool, you know, that has happened too. And that's a rewarding thing when it can happen that way.
Well, and then there's that interesting dynamic too, of like you and the rest of the band where, you know, maybe you come up with something that are like, I had no idea it was going to go in that direction versus, oh, that was really cool. Or, oh, that was really different. Like Mike Mills said that World Leader Pretend, when they sent that to him, Michael Stipe, they thought it was a really poppy song and it became this kind of brooding other thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, you know, I think that's a something that happens all the time where, you know, one of those guys will send me something and I'll be like, oh, I was actually kind of hearing like a Cars thing, you know, like, and then, you know, all of a sudden you turn it into, you know, something different. But I think that's the power of collaboration, right? You know, like I can hear something differently and go in a different direction. And that's what's going to make it unique to us.
Are you an arguing band, or are you pretty much a, you know, all right, that's cool?
No, I wouldn't say we're an arguing band. I mean, you know, there will be conflict, but I think that, you know, I really try to, you know, there's that improv thing, like yes and.
Absolutely.
It's like, okay, all right, well, I don't like rather than say I don't like this, why don't I use my tools, you know, what my power to make it better and try to shape it into something that I like better. And I think that's sort of my creative mantra as collaboration, you know, rather than shut it down and be like, I don't know. Is it, you know,
right. And they're not coming back to you and saying, dude, this is a Cars song.
No. And I think they are. No. And they aren't. And, and so, you know, usually it's like, let's let's just push this forward and see where it ends up.
The shows you're doing with Patterson Hood, like, what's the format of those? Are you two on take turns? Are you on stage together the whole time? How's that going to work?
Our plan is we're bringing a our plan is to be both on the stage at the same time. And, you know, whether that's like song back and forth, I don't know. I think it's probably like, you know, maybe he'll play a few songs, I'll play a few songs, but, we're going to share, a utility musician, a guy named Ben Hackett, who I saw play with Patterson in his most recent solo tour. It was fantastic. He played synths and some horns. And, I was like, Patterson, we should get that guy. And we were able to, so that's exciting. So yeah, I think it's going to be kind of a loose, we'll see what it ends up being. We've done shows like this before. But I think it'll be, you know, a loose, storytelling, you know, both of us on stage, probably some conversation, some back and forth, and, I imagine it'll be a lot of fun. We're going to be traveling together, et cetera. He's a friend. He's also a hero. I mean, Drive-By Truckers is a band that I love and absolutely influenced the Hold Steady. And then we became friends. So, it's kind of a dream come true. And I think it'll be a very, I don't want to use the word loose, but I'd rather use the word fun.
Yeah,
that it's a mess, you know.
No, and I would recommend to readers to find your Substack on Drive-By Truckers and Patterson, because you have a really like nice long, you know, detailed essay about sort of your interactions with them and how they, you know, inspired you and how you became, you know, you eventually became friends after sort of admiring each other's music and the things that you do similarly to each other from the Upper Midwest versus the South.
Yeah, I mean, in writing that essay, I had a really, you know, a funny memory of, you know, it took writing the essay to remember this, really, and, you know, kind of going full circle of the podcast and memory, but of me going up with the Hold Steady's first CD, and they were playing Letterman, and I went off after my work day and kind of hung out outside the theater there in case I could catch a glimpse of them. This is before I knew them. I wanted to give them the Hold Steady CD. And they never materialized and I went home. But like, it's a funny memory to think about that because we've been friends, you know, good friends for a long time now. But there was a time when I was sort of hoping to become his friend.
Well, it's funny because I'll sometimes go back to like Robert Christgau's Consumer Guide. You know, when I'm sort of like revisiting a catalog, and he says in his review of Boys and Girls in America the first sentence of the review is Sasha Furuk Jones has nominated the Mountain Goats, and now the Decemberists come to mind, even though their songs are fictive rather than reported, recollected, observed. But for me, the nearest parallel to this band is the Drive-By Truckers.
Yeah, great. I mean, there was another review, and I think in Seattle Weekly around almost killed me, that said, and I think put this in the essay, that said it's like Drive-By Truckers for Northerners. And I was like, that's exactly what I was trying to do with this.
Great. Well, thank you so much for talking with me. You know, you spent a lot of time talking on podcasts. So, all right. Well, hey, great talking with you. I really appreciate it. So,
yeah, I really appreciate it. It was great.
That's it for episode 191 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Craig Finn for letting us turn the podcasting tables on him and for revealing so much about his own memory and creative work. His latest solo album, Always Been, is out on vinyl, CD, and streaming on the 30 Tigers label. He's on a bill with the Decemberists and Kevin Morby on July 27th at Out of Space in Skokie, Illinois. On August 3rd, he'll perform in a Hamilton Park House concert in New York, and several East Coast dates with the Mountain Goats follow. In October, you can see Craig Finn and the Band of Forgiveness in a bunch of places, including Lincoln Hall in Chicago on October 18th. His West Coast shows with Patterson Hood start November 5th in Seattle. Go to craigfinn.net for more information about tour dates, his music, and him. You can find his Substack, Versions of Security, there too. His podcast, That's How I Remember It, is available through his Substack and on Apple Podcasts and other outlets. He's on Instagram at SteadyCraig. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Swake, who's also never been with your little hood rat friend. Thanks to all who support Carol Pop. If you'd like to throw something into the Carol Pop kitty, we'd be much appreciative. You can give $24 or whatever you'd like at carolpop.com.
Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Caro Pop on the so-called socials at Caro Popcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Caro, at M-A-R-K-C-A-R-O. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Caro Pop Conversation. Thanks.